We're going to have to try to find a smaller basket, I think. Okay, well, we'll give it a shot. Okay, first question is, what was that onomatopoeic word you mentioned? What does it mean again? I forgot. Vichikicca, which is that skeptical doubt, the last of the five hindrances. The fourth one is really good as well, which is restlessness. Uccuccha, cuccuccha. You can almost see the mind turning. I understand that you recently read Ajahn Jeff's wonderful new book, Skill in Questions. Might you share an insight that struck a fresh chord in your heart? Let's see what comes to mind. It was excellent. It was really good. And, you know, I think maybe what sticks in my mind is, and I'm still not quite finished it, but the just that sense of really seeing how thorough and skilled the Buddha was in being able to really not just sort of answer questions, but to guide one's own questioning process through that use of questions and answers. And so that that I feel is really in the sense of as a, if one is a real skeptic, then being able to read how the Buddha approached the whole spiritual quest and then encourage one to rely on criteria that would be able to then really inform one's own spiritual understanding in a very concrete way. So maybe that's I remember thinking of somebody was really extremely skeptical that would be a great book to give them. Seems like the mind and body are unreliable, not good refuges. Yet everything about the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha relies on the mind training, refining, watching, letting go. It sounds like it still relies on the mind. What am I missing? Well, I think the thing is what, you know, not missing anything really. Both of those are true statements in the sense that, the mind and body are unreliable, not good refuges. And then everything relies on the training, refining, watching, letting go, relies on our own discernment and wisdom and clarity that we have to develop. The problem is we tend to, there's a stock phrase from the suttas which kind of describes the predicament of the human condition, of the human mind, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. And as long as that is the kind of the watchword, then it's not at all reliable. And to be able to untangle that knot of being bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving, that's what the whole practice is for. Once we can do that, then of course that is that's a true refuge. And then the second part of this is, what are mind conditioners? Are they feelings, habits, or something else? The word in the Pali is citta sankhara, and sankhara has a citta is mind, heart. Sankhara is a word that is used in different contexts, and in this sense it's more of the active process, so that which is conditioning the mind, that which is concocting the mind, so that the factors of that conditioning on its most basic level are, as was mentioned, feeling, perception. Then it grows into habits, and of course they feed back into feelings and perception. So it's these are multi-feedback loops that are keeping the mind spinning. So that's being able to tease that apart a bit so that we're not just blindly following those those habits and that those conditionings. While doing walking meditation today, a pleasurable sensation started unfolding in my body. When my mind reacted, it vanished. When mindfulness was reestablished, it reoccurred. This time I tried to lean into and investigate, and it similarly fizzled. Is sukha common during walking meditation? How should I skillfully work with this? Anytime when there's a continuity of attention, awareness, clarity, well-being will establish itself. So that, one, it's really good to, say, to experience that in the sense that it gives some encouragement to develop the walking meditation. Sometimes, I think as a forest monk, we sometimes can be a bit missionaries for spreading the word of walking meditation. Because that sometimes it's sort of like the poor cousin to sitting, or it's something you do when you can't sit any longer. But yeah, walking meditation is just, I mean, it's just as valid a practice as the sitting. And I think the being able to just use these different postures as a means of establishing that continuity of attention, then yeah, there's a natural arising of pleasant sensation when the mind starts to focus and settle. Of course, as you find out, and then the mind sort of reacts, grasps onto it, it crumples because of that, and so that one just needs to be able to establish that sense of awareness and attention that isn't trying too hard to hold on to the sensation or over-analyzing what one is experiencing, because it, similarly, it'll just shatter because once the mind is taking possession of it, it's trying to establish ownership. So to put in the causes for awareness, attention, relaxing into the practice, and then whatever arises will arise. And usually it's pleasant. When meditation is strong, awareness automatically falls upon the object and both melt away quickly. However, sometimes hindrances cloud the mind and the mind wanders. Is it best to develop more concentration? I've been experimenting with breath sensations. I think, I mean, there isn't a categorical answer to this, in that the you can only experiment with it and see what happens. But as concentration becomes more refined and settled, then the hindrances will fall away more, and then the mind becomes more settled and clear, and one's able to, say, absorb into the object of attention, so that there's a following away of distinction and division. But the other side of the coin as well is that investigation, and again, not over-analyzing, but the investigation in the sense of attending carefully to the phenomena that one is experiencing can give an insight into the nature of that experience. And that kind of investigation leads to sort of very settled and bright states of mind as well. So that, and that's where, even in the Buddha's time, you know, different people approach the practice in different ways, and sometimes some would lead with concentration and then, say, follow up with investigation, insight. Some would lead with investigation and insight, and the mind would settle after. So that it's not a fixed formula, and one really does have to experiment a bit to see what fits at any particular time, or what tends to fit one's own temperament and personality. What is the most skillful thing to do when we can feel that there's a lot of blockages around the various energy centers in our body? I think the... I'll continue my plug for mindfulness of breathing. In that sense of allowing the breath to be the kind of the interface between what we feel or experience as blockages, what we feel that there is some kind of either tension or imbalance in the body and in body-mind complex, and as using that breath as a means of soothing and kind of soothing and settling that particular feeling and experience, to breathe into it, to allow the breath to wash over that area with a certain softness, a gentleness, and a clarity. And so that there's a kind of there's an ability, because oftentimes when you think of blockages, it's tight. It's tight, it's constricted. And then to be able to breathe into that and allow the breath to wash over that and through it, and then to let it expand from there. I mean, that's what I've found has worked well for me. Are the Dhamma talks being taped for CDs or audio downloads on the internet? I think we can't get away with not recording every single word that comes out of our mouths. They're all being recorded, and they will take them back, clean them up, probably do a bit of editing. If Ajahn Pasano could go back in time and give a word of advice to Venerable Pasano on the day of his ordination, what would he say? Well, actually, on the day of his ordination, wouldn't it be a good time to tell him anything? He really didn't know what he was doing. But, you know, if I could go back in time and tell the young monk Pasano, one of the big regrets I have of my monastic life is being not asking enough questions of Ajahn Chah, and then putting off questions, thinking, oh well, I'll ask some other time, or and then all of a sudden he was. You know, he got so ill that he lost his speech and was completely bedridden, so couldn't ask questions anymore. And that's certainly a regret. So that sense of, if you've got a question, ask it, or clarify the things that you don't understand with a good teacher. That I would have given myself that advice. Could you explain the role of enjoyment within the context of taking food with the purpose of nourishment? Sometimes the reflections that one has are to curb a natural tendency, so that there's a natural tendency to enjoy food. I mean, it just goes across every culture. That's probably the most, one of the most social events in any culture is taking of food. So that, I think enjoyment in the, one keeps reminding oneself that it's not just for the purpose of enjoying or to get swept up into the feeling, because that's the tendency, that's the habit, that's one brings to mind things to counter the habits. One of the things to do when you're eating, like bringing a spoon of food or a mouthful of food, and you put it in your mouth, and to actually pay attention to how long it is that it's in your mouth before your eyes are already going to the next mouthful. It's not very long usually. So that sense of we get swept up in the enjoyment. Another take or perspective on that is in the monastic discipline, there's a gazillion kind of rules and trainings, and one of the things that say that the Buddha allows, and when the Buddha allows, it usually means you should be doing it, is the use of toothwoods, cleaning the teeth, so that to you make up these toothwoods and then you clean your teeth with them, and you know, there's not supposed to be shorter than this or longer than that, and there's advice on how to do it. But then the Buddha gives one of the advantages of using toothwoods, cleaning one's teeth properly, is that food tastes better. So the Buddha wasn't against things tasting good. It's just that sense of being swept up in the mood, the attachment, the pleasure, and forgetting the context of it. Can you review the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing? I won't go into a full review. That'll take a while. But as I mentioned this morning, of that is focused around the four establishings of mindfulness, so body, feeling, mind, and dhammas. The first four of around the body, of the knowing the long in-breath, long out-breath, and knowing short in-breath, short out-breath, knowing or experiencing the whole body as one's breathing in, breathing out, calming the body formation as one breathes in, breathes out, experiencing rapture, breathing in, breathing out, experiencing pleasure, breathing in, breathing out, experiencing the mind conditioner, the citta sankhara, which Ajahn Kurundamo talked about this afternoon, and then calming the citta sankhara. So in the section of feeling, in the section of mind, is experiencing the mind, breathing in, breathing out, gladdening the mind, breathing in, breathing out, settling the mind, concentrating the mind, breathing in, breathing out, liberating the mind, freeing the mind as one breathes in, breathes out. Then the last section on dhammas, contemplating impermanence as one breathes in, contemplating dispassion as one breathes in, breathes out, contemplating cessation as one breathes in, breathes out. And the last one, contemplating relinquishment. So that's the sort of overview of those 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. Please kindly share stories of your teacher, Ajahn Chah.
Thank you.
So I've tried to weave some in from time to time when it's appropriate, and I'll continue to try to remember stories of Ajahn Chah or aspects of his teaching. So I will file that one away and see if I come up with as these days continue. I often find myself wondering if it is equanimity or indifference I'm experiencing. Could you please enlighten me? No pun intended. Thank you. The difference between equanimity and indifference is that equanimity is a wholesome mental state. Indifference is an unwholesome one. So that how we would experience it is that equanimity would be a place of balance. There'd be a brightness. The mind would experience a deep sense of well-being. And there's a real clarity there. Indifference would be kind of a cold, unfeeling, and fundamentally negative, and then lack of interest. So there's lack of interest, lack of don't care, doesn't matter. So that there's a huge difference between equanimity and indifference. They have a certain similar characteristics, but the indifference will be, it won't be expansive, it won't be bright, and So then it's not very fruitful as a mental state in conjunction with Dhamma practice. Is there a chant or a few lines that you can suggest to provide a smooth transitional bridge from chanting something such as salutation to the triple gem into meditating on the breath? I feel disconnected. Inspired by the meaning of the chant, and then suddenly I'm focusing on my breath. Did the Buddha have a few powerful verses reminding us of the value of breath meditation? I think one of the things in terms of the, say with the chanting, then it's, these are recollections of the, say of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and one could use that as a part of the breath meditation as a transition, and thinking of the, you think of the, that first line of the Bundo Susuto Karuna Mahanavo, the Buddha absolutely pure with ocean-like compassion. I mean, I find it very beautiful, you're breathing in those basic qualities of the Buddha and breathing out with that. So that using the aspects of faith in the qualities of the Buddha might be useful. Breathing in, breathing out the recollections of the rupang anicchang, say the body is impermanent, feelings are impermanent, perceptions are impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, just breathing in, breathing out, recollecting those realities. So that's a way. I mean, also, one of the things that I did in conjunction with working with anapanasati, with mindfulness of breathing, was to memorize the Pali phrases of the 16 steps of anapanasati, so that using those as a touchstone during the meditation, so that, you know, recollecting what the Buddha is actually advising during a particular step or times. Nowadays, that's easily accessible, and the Pali is, it's not that, you know, if it's just little chunks of phrases here and there, it's not that weird or distant. It's really easy to find the Pali these days. You go access the insight and hover over the, put your cursor over the number of the sutta, and then it comes into the Pali. It's a really neat feature. Are transitions from stream entry to once returner, once returner to non-returner subtle, or are there strong inside experiences? Will one be able to tell if he or she has moved to the next stage? Oftentimes it's really not clear. I mean, they can be very strong, but oftentimes it's not really clear until in retrospect, when one really recollects and is able to verify, oh yeah, that really did drop away. That really did, was really able to relinquish that. Because it's the particular fetters or characteristics of the deluded mind that have fallen away. So that it's more, one has an intuition that, oh yes, one is, might have shifted from one stage to another, but then it isn't really until in retrospect that one can really verify for oneself that, yeah, that has really dropped away, that particular defilement, that habit, that fetter has fallen away. But one of the really, I think, it's in the text, this the once returner, and there's really almost hardly any literature about it at all. Even the Buddha doesn't really, he just sort of mentions it briefly, and so there's not much of a description of the experiences that take place for a once returner. If weeping starts to happen while sitting, is it best to leave the hall, or is it okay if some sound happens while in the group? Well, it depends how much sound. In a lot of, I say, weeping in general is not so noisy. But I mean, I think one of the things is to be able to, you know, to be able to just sit with it, and then be attentive to the whether or not one is affecting others. But sometimes it's really helpful to just sit with it and allow that feeling to be present. And then also, particularly in the hall, then there's a container of safety. I think that is really helpful to allow that to pass through, and you engage for yourself and say, okay, after sitting with it for a while and then recognizing, is it impacting others? Is it not? So then, if it is, then it's a kindness to others as well. But I think the first method of dealing with it, I think, is to continue to sit with it and be present. I've been feeling a large spaciousness in my body and in my head. I feel the outline of my form. What is a skillful way to deepen this place? I think just mindfulness, just staying mindful, staying present, and at that point, and it's a mindfulness of the space, a mindfulness of the, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it disorienting? Is it anchoring? Because one can feel space that is extremely settling and kind of freeing, light, spacious. There can be space which is more space cadet like, and they're really allowing that space to be something that one can say allow habits of mind or obstructions to dissipate, to fall off the edges. Because space also should be an opportunity for clarity. So allowing the clutter of the mind to fall away, and then allowing that clarity to establish itself. Sometimes when there's that feeling of space, then the breath has started to be either less interesting or less apparent. There's a feeling of settledness. And if that's the case, then to allow the awareness of the either of the form or how one experiences form, which is also an interesting object of attention, because sometimes what we try to do is then we're working from memory of what our physical form should be like. And you say, well, what is the actual feeling? What's the sensation? And then allowing that the experience to unfold from that place. As the feeling of the object of space becomes a bit more apparent, then one can also use just the awareness of knowing, the mind, the mental state, the quality of attention itself as the object, as opposed to trying to fix the object as something physical or tangible. And so experimenting with that. Can you elaborate on how to bring practice within the daily life setting? Even here, I feel I can walk around within my own bubble with my attention mostly focused inwardly. Can you describe how practice works when attention needs to be engaged in the fast-paced external world? One of the things that is helpful for being able to bring this practice into daily life settings is that familiarity with the using the body as an anchor for attention, so that there's that ability to transition. Say one hasn't relied on some refined object of concentration, one's familiar with how to adapt the practice to being in the body in different ways. Also, just on a retreat setting, even though it's quite prescribed, but still, there's, you know, one gets up and moves from the hall, integrating that attention with that movement. Chores that need to be done, there's the recognition that there's other people around one that one has to be attentive to. There's things that can be done that could be, you know, just noticing some of the things that one can be helpful with, rather than just trying to contain one's attention really in a very fixed way, then paying particular attention to how to integrate or use or utilize that attention as we're moving into different postures, as we're contacting the world around us, even if it's just in a retreat setting, one's still making contact, and to experiment with that application, so that it's not just pushing that all away and trying to concentrate and hold the mind. Can you recommend any particular books which share the teachings of the Buddha in more user-friendly ways? Dhamma for Dummies. I found the readings from the discourses, canon, repetitive and hard to relate to, yet you share so many Dhamma tidbits which are captivating and memorable. Off the top of my head, one that stands out would be Bhante Gunaratana's 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness. I found that really, really fresh, and you know, great stories, great explanation, and always on track. And that's one that comes to mind.
In the Buddha's words.
Oh, yeah, the Bhikkhu Bodhi's in the Buddha's words, because it takes the sutta explanations, but then gives them a context, an explanation. It fills it out. It puts a context around it. So that's a very useful collection.
I mean, as far as tidbits go, you can the Anguttara Nikaya. I mean, that's got some great tidbits in it. It's just a collection of tidbits.
Yeah, it's true. And that's still not Bhikkhu Bodhi has been working on that translation for a long time. I can remember he was visiting, how many years ago was that? That's got to be 6-7 years ago anyway. And everybody's asking, we've heard you've been working on the Anguttara Nikaya. When is it going to be finished? He said, well, I finished the translation. I just got the footnotes to do it. it's still not out. He's definitely a detail person.
There's his anthology. Is you can get that on like Amazon.
Oh, of the
Anguttara.
Yeah, Numerical Discourses. It's a smaller collection. That's a very good one. Anybody else? Yeah.
What'd you say?
Life of the Buddha. Jnanamoli's Life of the Buddha. It's an old book that has been around for a long time. And it's taken a lot of the kind of the repetition of the suttas. There is no chronological sort of life or story of the Buddha in the discourses. It's all a jumble. So that Jnanamoli, that'd be in the 1960s, I think, early 1960s probably, that the book was printed. But anyway, he's taken teased all that out, and then tried to find both a chronological of the life of the Buddha and then a presentation of the essential teachings. So it's really a excellent book. It's much more readable than the repetition of a lot of the sutta.
Actually, it's with that book, there's 3 voices. It's done in the form of like a radio program. So you have 3 voices. Like one is the historical voice, which will kind of say the history of something. And then another voice is the sutta voice, which is like sections from the suttas. And then another voice is like the commentarial voice, like commentaries to the suttas.
Yeah.
So you hear these different kind of angles on different takes. It's quite nice.
You say it's like a radio program. What to do when the meditation practice seems dry and barren, a tedious, joyless exercise? I think we've all been through that. One of the things that I've always done, I found helpful, is some reading biographies of some practitioner, or from the time of the Buddha, or some contemporary, or some from the past, so that it's sort of seeing the story of a real person who's practicing and has experienced some benefit from the practice, so that sense of connecting. Because sometimes if you just, you're practicing and it's dry, and then you read some dry, boring Dhamma book, and this is totally oppressive. The biographies, I find very, very helpful, because it should make it into something. Well, these are real people practicing, and they go through their ups and downs and difficulties. I've always appreciated Ajahn Chah's, his own, when he's teaching, but also the telling the stories of his life, because he never covered over his own foibles and failings. And to me, I find that more inspiring than when you read a biography of somebody who's, seems that they were enlightened from birth. I mean, it's sort of, it doesn't do me much good. recognizing that some of these great practitioners had to go through all sorts of difficulties and problems, and had their own misunderstandings of Dhamma practice. It was like Ajahn Chah, remember one time him saying, because he was really experimenting with practice, and really putting his heart into the practice, and then he came across this. It's a phrase from the suttas and the commentaries of making the practice even. So he's making the practice even. Maybe that means I have to do everything really evenly. So then he started walking for 2 hours, sitting for 2 hours, lying down for 2 hours, standing for 2 hours. And I said, and after doing that for a while, I said, this can't be it. So that, I find that really quite encouraging. So, because even a mistake or a misunderstanding can be beneficial. And you realize, even somebody, some great teacher like Ajahn Chah, he certainly floundered around. Can a person be enlightened without ever sitting? Or without ever hearing the Dhamma? Was anyone ever enlightened before the Buddha? The Buddha himself characterized his teaching or his awakening as him finding an ancient path that had been neglected, had been covered over, so that there has been enlightened beings prior to the Buddha, and he was, awakening to an ancient lineage or ancient possibility. The sitting aspect is, not so essential, in the sense of, what is most essential is the quality of mindfulness and wisdom. And generally the sitting practice is a helpful tool. And there's some practitioners I know who don't use the sitting posture that much, but there's a special effort put into, walking meditation, or the But that's usually the sitting is an opportunity for stilling, and that the quality of stilling and settling is essential. It isn't so much that it's the sitting that is the crucial thing, it's that ability to settle, to still internally. Of course, there was a question asked of Ajahn Chah, you know, is it necessary to sit for long periods of time to progress in the practice? And, you know, his response was, well, chickens sit for a long period of time, and they don't get very far. So that, but then if one ever saw Ajahn Chah sit, and there was something really special about when he sat meditation, you know, kind of lead us as a group, it's just always just rock solid. It was like, you know, seeing a mountain sitting there. It was really very special. The question about without ever hearing the Dhamma, that's the critical part. In the sense of to be able to hear the Dhamma, to be able to hear the teachings of the Buddha, to be able to be exposed to an exposition of truth. Because the basic mode for us is, as that phrase I mentioned earlier, you know, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. And as long as that is the baseline, then without hearing Dhamma, without being able to be exposed to teachings, to true teachings, then it's very impossible, really. You can, you know, we circle around and around our habits. There's a nice question in Thai about wanting to have some explanation around Hiriyotapa. And I'll work that into a Dhamma talk. Hiriyotapa is it's an essential part of the growth of the human heart and foundation for practice. And it's in the English language, it's really very difficult to come up with a good term. Traditional ones are sort of shame and fear of wrongdoing sort of thing. But it's, Ajahn Yatiko mentioned, it's the respect for oneself and respect for others. And that's actually the critical factor that allows Hiriyotapa to establish itself. Could you speak about the subtle ringing in the ear, also I believe known as the sound of silence, as a meditation object, both on its own and in conjunction with Anapanasati? That's something that Ajahn Sumedho used, developed on his own. It's something that Ajahn Amaral, because he spent many years with Ajahn Sumedho, so he developed it as a meditation. I mean, it's just taking, say, rather than the sensation of touch in terms of the breath coming in and out, then taking an audio sensation. Because also one can use visual images as meditation objects. One can use a concept as a meditation object. So that, this particular sound can be then used as an object of attention. And one can also do it in conjunction with anapana. I've never really developed it that much, but certainly it can be cultivated on its own or in conjunction with mindfulness of breathing. The sensation is there. There's that actual sound of silence, sound of spaciousness. Those can be attended to and used as a meditation object. It's sometimes a good way of letting the chatter of the mind dissipate and fall away. I also have had more of a pedestrian view of the Dhamma, and for the first time I'm having trouble even referring to the Buddha as the Lord. Can you review taking refuge in the Buddha? Likewise, who is Lord Sahampati for the chant of requesting a Dhamma talk? Yeah, I can appreciate that. It's always difficult translating concepts into a language that doesn't have the, you know, the concepts that we have tend to be focused around a supreme deity. You know, it just doesn't fit sometimes. But in terms of the Buddha, then what it's trying to convey is the quality of respect, reverence, and gratitude, in terms of recognizing that the Buddha was a special being, and that the legacy that he has left us is one that is really deserving of respect. So that I can appreciate that, you know, the Lord as a being having very Christian connotations, and I'm not even sure how they ended up using that in the translations. It was, I know there was a committee. And I'm sure there were many discussions. And for me, it was sort of something that inherited. It was translated in England. And I know they spent a lot of time trying to come up with something that people would accept. And it's imperfect. Whatever the language, I think it's helpful to that taking refuge in the Buddha is that taking refuge in those qualities of the Buddha that, as I say, just the word buddho, meaning the one who knows, the awakened one, the bright, spacious being, also the traditional recollections of the Buddha are around that sense of, say, even the word, say, the Blessed One is, in the Pali, it's the Bhagawa, and that's referring to one who brings blessings in the sense of compassion. So that sometimes it takes a bit of unpacking what those phrases are really referring to, because, say, the qualities of the Buddha are the traditional qualities that are being, say, constantly referred to or alluded to are, there's three in particular that everything revolves around, and wisdom, compassion, purity. And these are like this kind of the three bases of that provide all the others are kind of branch off from that. But those are the fundamental characteristics or qualities of the Buddha. So that sense of wisdom, penetration, understanding, and the quality of compassion, that bringing blessings into the world, being willing to teach, the quality of purity, in the sense of here's a being who has completely liberated the heart and has no residue of selfishness left. So that those are the three sort of fundamental qualities. Then when other aspects which are very traditional, in the sense of that being, as it's translated, impeccable in conduct and understanding, vijaya-charana sampanno, which means like sampanno is sort of like complete or replete. So being complete and replete in conduct and knowledge. So that those are kind of aspects of the, when we take refuge in the Buddha, if we can sort of scramble over some of the language and come to the underlying qualities, and it's very helpful. Sahampati is a Brahma god in the story of the Buddha. Then it's a It's a particular Brahma God, high being, high deity who invited the Buddha to teach. I've noticed that my heart is really open in the evenings. Will you lead us in a metta meditation one of these evenings? One of the reasons why we have questions and answers in the evening is because that's my dullest time. When I'm able to sort of set my own rhythm, and it's like I'm a morning person. Evening times I struggle with. So people can have metta for me and not. Ha, ha, ha.